Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are at 12:11 on this Monday afternoon. Welcome to the work week post St. Patrick's Day holiday. We'll talk to the folks from Chicago Inno to start things off in the program. Then Philip Weiss will be along to talk about turnover in the workplace and why are you leaving your job. Randy Schaefer, digital editor for the Chicago Tribune as well, stops by in the second half hour. But we start with the folks from Chicago Inno. They're sponsored by Illinois Tech's Stewart School of Business. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio, as they are most Mondays. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Steve.
Oh, look at that. It's such a rough start. I don't even have the mics on. I'm still thrown by everything. How are you guys? Nice to see you again.
Good to be here.
All right. So there's the news on a couple of fronts. A lot to read at Chicago Inno, but we're just getting word now that Uber has suspended its driverless car testing in several cities, and that's after an accident last night in Tempe, Arizona. I don't know. What do you know about it, Jim?
So some of the details are kind of just coming out, and I think we're still kind of learning the details of exactly what happened. But yeah, it looks like a woman was struck by a self-driving Uber vehicle in Arizona. What appears to be the first pedestrian death from a driverless vehicle, maybe in the world. So we're still kind of learning a lot of the details about exactly what happened. But certainly big news in the tech world.
Catherine, I would imagine it's something that we knew would happen, right? Even though it's
it's just one of those unfortunate things. Whenever you're testing new tech, you know, accidents happen. There's been people who've been pushing back on autonomous innovation and been saying that it's a bad idea. So some of those people today might be saying they told us so.
And certainly been a lot more people killed by driven cars today than driverless.
Certainly. And that's the thing about all this technology, too, is that really in a perfect world, driverless cars work the best when everything is driverless. I mean, they don't really, at least in these early stages, account for kind of these unpredictable things. I mean, maybe somebody just was walking in through the crosswalk when there was a red light.
Did you
right?
say, I don't know if you said, but the reporting I saw was that she was walking across the street outside of a crosswalk.
Exactly. So, I mean, we don't know. I mean, the car may have had the green light, but, you know, being able to account for, you know, the unpredictable, you know, how will a driverless car react when, you know, kind of in a more rural road, if there's a deer in the road, right? So there's a lot of things that the technology still needs to do to improve. And unfortunately, it's not 100%.
Well, you know, we're thinking of Ed Burke, because Ed Burke was one of the people here in Chicago who wants to prohibit any testing. So
safety, obviously, is the number one thing, right? But I mean, all these technology companies want to scale and grow and get this technology out as fast as they can. But I mean, at the cost of what, right?
So I'm driving around all weekend trying to understand the Facebook data analytics story. And Facebook has been suffering on Wall Street today because of all of that. And it's kind of a complicated thing. So I figured Jim Dahlke could do it in three sentences.
Ooh, three sentences. Okay, well, we'll try. So Facebook has suspended a data analytics firm that used some of its Facebook data, Cambridge Analytica. And this company worked very closely with the Trump campaign back in 2016. And so that's kind of what helps get some of the headlines for some of this. And so basically what happened is they were able to use some data that violated Facebook's terms of service. So personal user data that went beyond kind of what Facebook is allowing some of these third-party analytics firms
to use. So is the accusation then that they took this data and this is how they were able to super target voters in Wisconsin and Florida and Pennsylvania and elsewhere?
Exactly. I mean, I don't think we know.
So is this all part of the election investigation in a way?
So that's what we're going to find out shortly. So I think we're still kind of in the early stages of really kind of uncovering exactly what they had, what the specific data they had, and exactly what Facebook knew and when. But right now, what it looks like is that they were able to sort of get some deeper, more personal Facebook data of users based on a firm that I believe was doing some kind of academic research, was able to get that data about, personal information from users, and was able to kind of go beyond what Facebook is typically allowing analytics firms to use based on their terms of service.
So who's the bad guy here? Is it Facebook or is it data analytics?
Boy, I don't think either of those companies look great right now, right? Okay. I mean, if the Cambridge Analytics folks went too far into violating Facebook's terms of service, that's one thing. If Facebook knew this information a year ago and only kind of surfaced because the New York Times was sort of sniffing around, like, that's something to look at too. But I mean, it's just another reminder that, like, Facebook is a lot more than just your friendly tool for connecting with your neighbors, right? I mean, there's a lot of data that can be used in a lot of different ways.
Mark Zuckerberg is going to have a Sammy Sosa moment before a congressional committee, right? Mm-hmm. It's inevitable. He might as well just practice his English. that Sammy got away from and get it over with, because it's the longer he waits, the worse it is for him.
Yeah, a lot more to come here.
All right, Catherine Davis, another story. We talked about this briefly Friday, but you guys at Chicago have have an interesting angle on it, too. Apple is going to be in town this week, right, with a big announcement.
Yeah, March 27th. They're going to be at Lane Tech College Prep High School, where they're going to be, you know, the details around exactly what they'll be sharing are a little unclear, but it's going to be an education-related event.
And they don't usually do that outside of California, right?
Right. No, they usually do their events near their Cupertino headquarters in California.
And I think the last time they did an education announcement was in New York. But you guys point out that there might be a secondary benefit here.
Right. So just like Amazon looking for its HQ2, Apple is looking for another campus and is looking around, you know, kind of the middle of the country to put about 20,000 new Apple jobs. And Chicago is among the cities that certainly wants that. The mayor has been very vocal about that. What a great time to announce that. I mean, certainly there's no indications that like an announcement of that size is going to be made. But, if Apple were to choose Chicago, that would be a very nice time to announce that.
20,000 usually would be something you'd be doing flips over, but it looks small in comparison to Amazon.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the Apple announcement kind of gets overshadowed because everyone's been talking about Amazon. But I mean, 20,000 Apple jobs is nothing to slouch at.
No. And Amazon's coming to town this week, right?
Yep. So Amazon will be in town. This is the Cranes has the report, but they'll be looking at touring the proposed sites for it. So that includes like Union Station, the old main post office, and they'll be working with city officials to see if they really want to come to Chicago.
So, Jim, I just want you to hang out outside Union Station all day on Wednesday and see what you find out, okay?
Man, yeah, don't get your hopes up. They're doing this kind of through a lot of their
sites.
Are they
just doing this to be nice?
So, they were in D.C. recently kind of doing the same thing, I believe. They did the same thing in Denver. I mean, they are doing their due diligence here. Chicago's on the top 20 lists. I'm not getting my hopes up that Chicago's going to be the city. I mean, I think there are a lot of cities that make a lot of sense. Chicago makes sense, certainly, but I think that we are
You're
kind
damn
of,
right it does.
I think that it would be great if it were to come here, but I do believe that D.C. probably has the edge right now.
All right, that is Jim Dahlke from Chicago, and Catherine Davis in the studio as well.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's 12:23. I make that 12:22 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, Monday afternoon in the Allstate Showcase Studio. All right, Foxtrot is, and they've been on the show a couple times, Mike Lavatola and his partner as well, Taylor Bloom. They started at sort of this, I can never think of the word, procurement, or they would go through, find the finest champagnes or beers or whatever, and then they would deliver to your house within an hour, right? So my joke always was like, you've met someone in a bar, you go home, and all of a sudden you see there's no champagne or wine at home, Foxtrot would deliver it. But now that's going well, I guess, but now they're moving more and more into brick and mortar stores, right?
Yeah, so they are kind of revolutionizing the corner store concept, trying to make it more cool, trying to get people to frequent it more. And so they just raised a $6 million Series A round, and they're going to use that to expand this concept.
So the idea, they started with online, and they were simply a delivery place, fine products delivered in an hour. But are they being forced into the brick and mortar, or are they expanding it? What's their sort of approach as they do this?
So I think that they're finding that the brick and mortar side of their business is a really big part of their business. I mean, the CEO told me that he expects it to be kind of a 50-50 split in terms of online and brick and mortar. And that certainly surprised me in terms of like you kind of imagine everything sort of going the e-commerce route. But the brick and mortar element for them is really big. They have 4 stores in Chicago right now. They have plans to add more and to go national as well. And really they're kind of like tying in these experiences, right? So it's adding the coffee bar to the corner store. They're partnering with Ginny's Ice Cream in Lincoln Park to have ice cream in the corner store. So really the idea is you're going there, you're getting a coffee, you're getting ice cream, you're picking up, you know, some flowers and some wine on your way out.
They're not a high-end store, but they're not a not high-end store.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little fancier than your neighborhood 7-Eleven, right. But the idea is that you're still, you know, only paying for everyday essentials. It's not like, it's not super, super expensive.
Right, okay. So Skoll, could you get a tin of Skoll there?
You know what? You'd have to ask them. I'm not sure.
Okay. So they're expanding. They've got this cash. They're going to get bigger, and they're going to go into other markets.
Right. So starting starting in 2019, I believe, is when they say they're going to kind of ramp up their national expansion. And so they're going to be opening this, you know, corner store of the future into more cities.
I have no idea where Skoll came from. I have none whatsoever. Catherine, you wrote a lengthy piece, pretty in-depth piece, about digital media and how Chicago is kind of a good market for it. And there are a number of startups. I know the people from DNA Info, right, are giving it a shot. There are a number of companies trying to sort of score in the digital market or digital media business here.
Yeah. So, you know, several of them include City Bureau. They have a nonprofit model. The Tribe. They focus on, you know, millennial black culture coverage, The Athletic, which is 24/7 sports coverage. And then, like you said, the former editors from DNA Info launch Block Club Chicago. And so, you know, all of these startups are exploring different funding models, trying to figure out ways to remain sustainable as media continues to be like the hardest industry to operate in.
The Athletic, that's kind of a national site, isn't it?
They're a San Francisco-based startup, but their first site ever to launch was in Chicago. Oh, okay. And it's been one of their kind of bigger operations.
And I like the idea of the Tribe. It's for millennial African Americans, kind of, right? They say our stories aren't being told.
Right, yeah. So they're trying to expand that coverage, cover all neighborhoods in the city.
But here's the thing, right? What sets some of these apart is that they've got their own site, they put their stories up, but they're not trying to be the Chicago Tribune online or the Sun-Times online.
Right. They're operating in very niche categories. You know, so like Block Club is going to be neighborhood news, filling in the gaps that the Sun-Times in Chicago aren't. Like we said, Tribe, covering, you know, African-American culture here. And, you know, they're exploring crowdfunding campaigns, nonprofit designs, charging subscriptions. Block Club plans to charge $5 a month. So just, you know, different stuff that we're seeing coming out of.
Do you have a line in there, too, about Elon Musk?
Yes, and Elon Musk, this news actually just broke last week, but he's recruiting two senior staffers from The Onion to launch a new, like, comical
You didn't get fooled here, right? This is true.
This is true.
Okay. Elon Musk is so he's going to create sort of a comedy news site?
That's what it sounds like.
We have no idea like what the actual specifics are, but The Onion guys did confirm that they have joined Elon Musk to start a comedy venture in some sort of media company. So we don't know what it's going to look like.
You know, it sounds like they're setting you up for a headline.
I think The Onion and Clickhole, both of those products, have already been like kind of taking jabs at the announcement themselves. So yeah, that's been pretty funny to watch.
All right, that's Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis. Read a lot more at ChicagoInno.com. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Every morning on the opening bell,
5:25, the Inno Minute.
You can't miss it. Don't miss it.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And it is 12:37 here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. So are you working today? Are you gainfully employed? When's the last time you left the job? Or did the job leave you? In the studio right now is Philip Weiss, the president of Work Right Solutions. Philip comes by from time to time. And I want to start, Philip, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
This sort of the genesis of this segment started last week when you didn't ask how many people are fired by tweet, but the Secretary of State was fired by tweet. I'm looking at PolitiFact. They say, and you know, take this for what it's worth, because I guess you could figure out who or is not a senior staffer, but PolitiFact says 43% of President Trump's senior staffers have resigned so far in the administration. Big number. It's a huge, three cabinet secretaries I don't think has ever happened in this short of a period of time. So there's a big turnover there, which got me to thinking and you to thinking about turnover for the rest of us, right?
Yeah. In fact, bosses are not immune to what's happening in D.C. It kind of focuses their attention on their own workplace. And they also know, with the unemployment rate being fairly low, some say dramatically low, that they want to hold fast to their current employee base. So how to keep people employed and engaged is a key question for managers.
So you did the survey of workers, managers?
Workers, managers, mostly workers, mostly employees, over the last actually several months, and said to them, why did you leave your last place of
work? So they're gainfully employed now, presumably, but how did you disengage last time? I was surprised the biggest number is fired or let go.
Yeah, we were as well. And the way we
not by a lot.
No, about a third.
Right.
Which, if you look at the Washington Post reports over the weekend, that kind of matches the
Trump administration.
In the Oval Office and administration. But the way it was framed is, if you felt you were on the way out, if you felt it was a matter of time, you can call yourself fired.
Okay.
So the numbers allow a little bit of give, but it was fascinating to see that there were a lot of parallels between government jobs, even at the highest level, and corporate America.
And let's get back to what you said earlier, though. The employers should be a little concerned about this, because I would imagine that that number, that 33%, is much lower in these days because workers are bouncing around because there's just great opportunity right now.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, approximately an equal number of people who left cited mismanagement, poor management, clownish management as the reason that they drove them out the door. And that's actually interesting both from the political and the business perspectives. A lot of the issues we see is bosses not really defining people's roles.
Right.
Whether you are the president in the White House or down the street.
Wasn't there a story about one guy who let people rewrite their own job descriptions?
Yeah, that's a really important example, because part of it is defining the jobs sufficiently and not letting employees run away with what they want to do just because they feel they've got a good entitlement to a position. So in this case, the manager ended up dealing with all kinds of chaos, including turnover.
Because he let people write their own description.
He said, I want you to feel engaged, included.
Right.
You should have a voice. You can take a shot at rewriting your own job description. One guy wrote down that he would like, in fact, he said he will now, going forward, spend the first 2 hours of the day just thinking quietly at his desk.
I would like that job.
Yeah,
I could
me
do
too.
That. Yeah.
Another guy, and this may have been with a bit tongue-in-cheek, because I think the first guy was serious. This other gentleman wrote down that 4 to 5 p.m. is the time he will devote to planning happy hour in order to boost morale. And that was another daily.
So he's a giver.
That's right. Yeah.
So you mentioned job descriptions, and this is off the beaten path a little bit, or off the subject, but why are job descriptions impossible to understand?
Yeah, they shouldn't be.
But they, I mean, right? Is it because the employer is trying so hard to protect themselves, or?
Yeah, that's a really important question. Part of it is they try to throw everything but the kitchen sink in there so that no matter what they ask you to do, they can turn back to the description
and say,
yeah, you know, it's there. What's really important, Steve, is to separate the description into segments. What are those core, those key, what we call those essential parts of the job?
Right.
And make sure you've explained those sufficiently and even given examples. And then the other stuff should be in a section lower, because there's going to be that kind of that bucket of what else is required.
I see, right.
But let's not mix the water between what's really key and what else you might need to do.
Yeah, because, you know, I read some of those and I'm like, I don't really know what this job is.
Yeah.
I have no way of figuring out what this job is.
There's a real push now among employers to convert policy speak, job description gobbledygook,
yeah,
into plain English.
That's a job. That's someone's job, isn't it?
We need a job description for that job.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think someone could do that, to write business speak in English, and it could change the world. Philip, we're going to change the world today.
Well, we'll start now.
Before you go, though, I want you to tell me the other story, because one of the stories about President Trump is that he enjoys sort of the conflict of the people who work under him, which makes it very uncomfortable. And you have the story about a florist?
Yeah. You know, that dynamic is surprisingly common in the private sector as well. The florist, an owner of a floral company, came to us because of complaints that he was getting about his own conduct.
He didn't want to be retrained.
That's right. And I give him credit. But in pursuing what made him viewed as abrasive, we uncovered this tradition, and I'm not telling you with his permission after the fact,
right,
which is what he called the Friday flower fights, where it was like a cage fight, a joust, where two employees were set up to verbally attack each other based on their ideas for the next best-selling flower arrangement.
So they would come up with their own arrangements.
That's
and then
right.
Argue over each other. And I'm picturing, well, first of all, you're working in a florist shop. I don't think that you're probably there for conflict.
It contravened the entire core value of the
right.
organization.
That's
making people's lives better versus arguing about flowers.
So there you see two examples. The one story about your own job description, which made it too easy.
Too easy.
And this other one, which made it too tough.
That's right. You want to find the balance. You do want to empower people, but you don't want to let them loose. And that goes to the core of good management.
Philip Weiss is the president of WorkRight Solutions. Great to see you again.
Good to see you.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. Realistic goals for every company are vital, but shooting for the stars is also a great way to make a stand in the market. Winston & Strawn, a Chicago law firm, is looking to reach $1 billion in revenue this year after a recent hiring spur. It's just one example of a company trying to adapt and break through in their respective industry. So how are you making waves in the city to make your name pop? Hazel Technologies is doing that by taking us into the future. The Chicago company has created a technology that helps extend vegetable and fruit shelf life by placing a small vapor-releasing packet in each shipment to cut down on food waste. Late last week, they secured a $3.26 million round of funding. This is definitely not the last time you're going to be hearing about Hazel Technologies. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's 12:51 on this Monday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I thank it, and so does I thank you, and so does my family. In the studio, Randy Schaefer, who's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune and comes by on most Mondays to talk about social media. Randy, welcome.
Hey.
So I've been looking at your Instagram feed, and how do I put this? I've noticed that you've been wearing the same outfit more than once.
Yeah.
And well, I think in order to keep up, I don't think you should post Instagram pictures of yourself in the same outfit more than
well,
one time.
Well, Steve, are you going to buy me a new wardrobe?
Some people have been doing that, right?
They have, yes. So this story that we're talking about is about, well, which one did you want to start with?
Well,
I sent you two very similar ones.
I switched them up on you, but let's start with that. This woman, this girl who lived in, I don't know if she was in Florida or something, but she decided she wanted to become an Instagram influencer.
Yeah, so this story, Christian Golian wrote it for the New York Post about a 26-year-old named Lisette Calviero who ended up $10,000 in debt because she was just trying to make her Instagram look cool. That sounds kind of harsh, but, you know, it was very keeping up with the Joneses, where it was like she felt all this, you know, societal pressure to buy new outfits and handbags and to go out for lunch every day and to take photos of these expensive lattes and ended up $10,000 in debt.
Am I supposed to feel sorry for her? Because I don't.
You know, you don't, but I kind of do because I'm her age a little bit. And so I kind of get it.
Well, that was the most gentle way I've been called old this week. It's Monday, but... But you do get it. Explain that for me.
I get it. You know, I see it a lot. Even, you know, my friends, they'll post things, you know, Rent the Runway. This was actually the service that this Lisette was talking about, where she just rents designer clothes every month instead of buying them for herself. So, like, I have friends that use this service, and I have friends that'll say, like, oh, you know, like, I can't put that on Instagram. It's an outfit that I've already worn. So I get it. I understand it.
And is it self-imposed, or... are those same people saying, oh, look, she posted herself on Instagram again in the same clothes?
You know, I think it's a little bit self-imposed. I honestly could not tell you if my friends have worn the same outfit right. twice on Instagram. But at the same time, peer pressure has been around forever. This is just a new way of expressing it.
So, you know, when I was a kid, I dreamed of maybe growing up to be an NBA player or a baseball player or, you know, a president or sort of things like that. Is this part of the younger generation wanting to become a quote-unquote social media influencer?
Oh, absolutely. And this isn't even my generation, the millennials, so much as the generation underneath us, Gen Z. You know, they're born into this. And, you know, we've talked before about how there are classes to, like, groom these kids to be Instagram influencers.
Right. And so she has broken out of this?
Yeah. So she met with a financial counselor and ended up paying off her debt. And now she still has her Instagram followers, but she's a little bit better with money, she
says. She find that doing that, I mean, did she ever get close to achieving her goal? Of being an influencer or being...
You know, I looked at her Instagram and her bio says influencer, so I guess it's self-fulfilled, you know, if she thinks she is.
I'm going to change my bio then, I guess.
There you go.
but that sort of relates to a study that you pulled from Alliance Life, and it talks about the fact that millennials, again, this is the generation above maybe, but millennials more than the others... feel this pressure, right, to sort of keep up because of social media.
Oh, absolutely. And it was an astounding 90% of the survey respondents, millennials, said that they felt pressured to keep up because of what they saw on social media.
Yeah, but so I am not a millennial. I'm a baby boomer, one of the youngest baby boomers, mind you. But I mean, I think we all feel that pressure if we look at social media or if we drive down the street and say, oh, there's where such and such lives.
Right. And again, this isn't a new thing. You know, there's always been looking over the neighbor's fence, like, what do the neighbors have that I don't? Like, they have a pool. I need one that's twice as big.
Right, right.
Now it's just more widespread and it's more global because you can see what the rich kids in China are doing versus just your next door neighbor.
I would imagine, too, it's just constant. I mean, if you're constantly on social media.
Yeah, it doesn't stop. You can't just, you know, like, turn down the blinds and pretend the neighbors aren't there. It's in your face.
There's conflict there because the millennials more than others feel that pressure, but also 80% of them in this survey feel financially confident, 58% believe in saving for retirement, and 41% are saving. So there's some signs, and I've seen this elsewhere, that the millennials are becoming pretty financially responsible.
Yeah, and I've read that a lot too. And I, as one of the 41% with a retirement account, my 401k is doing well. I see a lot of my peers are also kind of shunning that mentality, and they're focusing on, like, you know, I'm not going to go to Starbucks today. I'm going to put this extra $5 in my savings account, kind of thing.
There's an essay that you pulled for me out of the UK, I think, about what happens when your friend disappears from social media. Which is fascinating, because my wife has friends who aren't active, very active, and, you know, so they end up missing a lot about each other. Things that they probably would have known had there not been social media, they would have been talking more often.
Right, exactly. And so I thought that this was really interesting. This was Faima Bakar from Metro UK that talked about a friend just went off social media, and suddenly this friend was in East Africa, and, you know, she had no clue because she didn't Instagram her plane ticket, or she didn't, like, check in at the airport. And it was kind of this piece about how we find ourselves losing those closer connections in favor of social media, because, you know, why email and check in when you can just pull up Facebook and you know what so-and-so's doing?
Well, it's funny you say that, because email and check-in is a shortcut too.
Right.
You know, why not call someone on the phone?
You had those party lines growing up?
I did have party lines. I didn't have them, but the people in my town did. Mm. Absolutely a party line. But I mean, I have this, you know, a friend who I used to talk to all the time, almost every day we would talk. And then, you know, when we moved away from that, then at least we would email.
Right.
And when you're emailing, you're constructing sentences. Now it's a text. It's a texting. And it's so diminished. I hate it.
Right, right. And that's, you know, part of also moving away, not having that close physical proximity. It's harder to keep up with friends when they're on the other side of the country than when they're in your office.
I had a coworker, and, you know, from time to time I'll think of a name. Like, oh, I wonder what such and such is doing. I Googled him and couldn't find him anywhere. I kind of assumed he had died.
Yeah,
I mean, I truly did, because
the
guy just disappeared from social media.
Yeah, it's crazy how prevalent social media is, and if someone doesn't have a presence, you just kind of forget they exist.
Right, but I don't think we're turning back at any time soon.
Unfortunately, no. We're kind of stuck with the Face, Twitter, Gram for a while.
Instagram, I'm trying to work on Instagram a little bit more. Is it true that they're coming now, they're filing their stories chronologically?
No. We all wish, but no, it's not true.
All right. Randy Schaefer, a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.